It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll hear stories from Wisconsin veterans on a special edition of Wisconsin Life. Now, the Milwaukee Journal-Sentinel reported last month that Wisconsin was second in the nation for attempts to recall local school board members. Disagreements over how race is taught in school drove a nationally watched recall election in the Mequon-Thiensville School District. Those recall attempts fell short last week, but they represent a growing focus on education in elections up and down the ballot in Wisconsin and around the country. We're finding out why education is becoming a big political issue and what it means for kids and their schools. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Is education a front-of-mind voting issue for you? Have you participated or voted in one of the local school board recall efforts in Wisconsin? If you're a parent, a teacher, a student, what do you make of the political fights over schools and what they teach and how they teach it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Rebecca Jacobson is an expert on education politics and a professor in the College of Education at Michigan State University. She's co-author of the book Outside Money in School Board Elections, The Nationalization of Education Politics. Rebecca, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, you wrote that book before this year and all this focus on education in elections. What do you make of what we're seeing this year in recent elections?
I think it's really interesting, the growth of interest in local school board elections. For so long, it was really hard to get anybody to pay attention to them. And that was actually one of the main criticisms of school board elections, was that they were these sleepy, off-cycle elections that nobody paid much attention to. And boy, has that changed.
There are a few different issues on people's minds. First, how schools handled the COVID-19 pandemic, issues about how schools teach about race. What do you think is driving so much interest here?
I think some of it is being driven by national organizations that are telling local parents and local community members that this is something they should be paying attention to. I think that parents have long paid attention to what's going on in their particular child's education, but we're certainly seeing more messages to people generally that we should be really concerned about what our schools are doing. And so I think that some of this is a nationalization effort, at least national actors trying to influence local schools.
What were you seeing before 2021 when you wrote your book, for example? How did money start to flow into local school board elections?
Yeah, one of the things that we stress in the book is that this is not a phenomenon that happens everywhere. But when it does happen, it often becomes a heated focus and a battle from the left and the right, or from one side and another side. When we were looking at the issues, one of the main polarizing topics was school choice, and things like teacher tenure and student accountability and teacher accountability. It seems like that topic has shifted, but some of the same sort of polarization and really strong stances where local communities can't seem to be able to talk across issues with one another, much like we see at the national level, is now happening at the local level as well.
That's elections. How about recalls? We had, as I mentioned, a district in Wisconsin fall short in a recall effort. Other efforts failed to get it on the ballot. We're hearing other states around the country. How common is it to see recall movements for school boards?
Yeah, they're not very common at all. And even in this particular year, where there were certainly far more than typical, it still wasn't very common. There still weren't very many across the country, though there was a sharp uptick in the number compared to previous times. And again, I think that comes from this nationalization where there were messages to parents and local community members saying, this is one of the strategies that you should be using if you are unhappy with your school boards. And so rather than promoting, you know, go and talk to them, figure out what's going on, observe the classes, one of the things that they were pushing was this idea of recalls. And so I think that's why we saw this sharp uptick this year.
WPR talked to a former school board member in that district, Mequon-Thiensville, who opposed the recall. Here's a listen to Paul Bazell.
Avoid every temptation to make it political, because you're going to turn off the people who otherwise could support the schools.
So a desire there for school boards to avoid making things political. But it seems like, again and again, through American history, politics does find its way in there one way or another.
Certainly it does. And our schools are a really important institution to us. But I do think that what we're seeing now is different than what we used to see. In fact, one of the complaints about school boards was that so often votes were unanimous, right? That people were able to get to consensus or sometimes, complete agreement on issues. And that some people took that as a sign that the school boards weren't doing their job, right? They were just sort of rubber stamping things or were slow to change. School boards were often a places where there was a lot of pragmatic decision making. And unfortunately, I think now we're sort of seeing the polar opposite of that, where we have some members who take extremely rigid stances in one way, other members who take extremely rigid stances other ways. And then you see this sort of swing back and forth. When we were looking at the elections in our work around school choice, we would see slates of people that were elected that were very much about promoting school choice. The other side would mobilize, and in comes a new, a new group of school board members, and then the policies would swing to the other side. And I think that that is really difficult for both the schools to react to, but also for the public. And I think that your clip really demonstrates this concern about turning off the public. We need parents and the public to support our schools, and I worry that we're turning them off with all of this polarization that we're seeing.
Talking to education professor Rebecca Jacobson from Michigan State University, looking at the politics of education. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are things looking like in your community, in your local school district? Things going smoothly, or are you seeing some of these political divisions over how schools are run, how things are taught, how they handled the pandemic? Is this an important issue for you in races, not just for school board, but for Congress or governor or beyond? 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. I saw an interesting poll, Rebecca, from Monmouth University. They asked a couple questions, among many others, about teaching about race in schools. When they asked, do you want to teach about the history of racism in the United States? A substantial majority of people said, yeah, do that. When they asked, do you want to teach critical race theory in schools? A minority supported that. What do you think about the debate over race and how it's taught in schools?
I think it's getting really confusing for people to understand what do these different terms mean and what does it mean for what my child will understand, what my child will think about themselves, and what my child will think about others in the world. And I think that's the really sad part, is that we can get a lot of polarization when we use terms like critical race theory. But really underneath that, as you mentioned, most people want to see schools that are talking about equity and fairness and, trying to eliminate racism. And I think that we're losing sight of where we do have a lot of common ground as we continue to use these polarizing and charged terms.
A lot of what happens in the classroom doesn't have anything to do with the teaching of race or pandemic preparedness or a lot of these divisive issues. A lot of it's just the practical stuff of keeping a classroom running and teaching kids. Do you worry that the political divides over this end up affecting the quality of education for kids?
I think it really does have the potential to have a very chilling effect on teachers, especially teachers who are teaching history or social studies, or when events happen in the world or their local community and kids come in with questions. I think when we have such polarization and quite frankly, such sort of sometimes nasty rhetoric coming from all different directions, that teachers are gonna be really wary of stepping into those spaces and going off script. And I think that means that we're gonna see some pretty boring teaching where teachers just stick to what is approved, what's in the lesson plan, and not really responding to where kids are at, what they're interested in, what they're asking teachers, somebody they really look up to for advice and thoughts about. And I think that's where we're going to really lose out on some of those, what we sometimes call teachable moments, right? Those opportunities where some of the best and most exciting learning can happen. And I'm not sure where else this could happen. Where else do we have spaces to come together and discuss these things, if not in the schools?
I'm seeing individual reports, some districts around the country taking books off of school library shelves, often ones that deal with issues of race and sexual orientation, often by authors of color or gay authors. Do you see this as a widespread trend? Have we seen this before, or is this just kind of a few anecdotes here and there?
I don't think it's just a few things here or there. I do think it's concerning, but I don't think it's all that new. We have seen schools become a flashpoint for culture wars before. It used to be around issues of evolution. That was certainly a point where a lot of times you saw school boards having some pretty heated debates about what should be taught in the science curriculum. Sex education has long been a point also of heated debate, but this topic of race being the point, I think, is what is new. But these heated debates over what we teach and how we teach it are not necessarily new.
Rebecca Jacobson is with us, expert in the politics of education at Michigan State University. She's with us today to talk about education as a political issue in recent elections, some of the driving forces behind that trend, some school board recall efforts. It's been cited education has as a big issue in the Virginia governor's race outcome. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you think schools did in handling the pandemic with some remote education along the way, or the things you wish they had done better? Are you fired up one way or the other about how issues of race and racism are taught in schools? Are you paying a closer eye on your local school board elections? Is education a voting issue that gets you interested in other races for state legislature, Congress, and beyond? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with Rebecca Jacobson, professor of education at Michigan State University. She's with us today for a closer look at what's driving a focus on education in recent elections in Virginia and New Jersey and here in Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are things pretty harmonious in your community, in your local school district, or do you see some of the divisions that are popping up around the country? Have you been involved in a recall effort, pro or con? Call 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. James is with us in Green Bay. James, hi.
Hi, how you doing? Thanks for taking my call. So we're talking about kids today learning about equality and learning about recent history. I know a lot of very unpleasant elderly folks. And for a lot of these folks, what was current events when they were in high school is now history. Maybe they were on the wrong side of it. There's still people alive that threw rocks at Ruby Bridges for going to school. There's still people alive who thought a good old Friday night in the 80s was to hang out outside a gay bar and beat up homosexuals. I think a lot of these people are uncomfortable with their kids and their grandkids learning about equality, and I think maybe that should make them uncomfortable.
James, thanks for the call. Rebecca, what do you think of that perspective?
I think that that's one of the challenges of schooling, is that oftentimes, you know, it can be used as a force to change society and move it forward. And that can make people uncomfortable. And so I think that, you know, your caller makes a really good point that some of what's happening maybe is good. I also think that parents have a right to be concerned about what's happening and know what's happening in their child's education.
James, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Heather joins us now in the greater Milwaukee area. Heather, hello.
Hi, thank you for taking this call.
What do you want to bring up, Heather?
Yeah, so you asked about any experiences with board decisions during protocol for COVID. I feel like the school board has done an amazing job with all of the protocols and trying to keep education going, but also trying to stay safe. They did a great job last year. I was surprised when they came out with an announcement that just explained a new protocol for this year, one of which gave the option to not wear masks at school. And I was curious, where did this come from and how did you get to this conclusion? And I went back to the board meetings that they recorded. They were making some decisions, but for some reason, when they got to that decision, they were no longer recording it, and it was just a few board members in a room. It didn't look like there was, I wondered if I missed a memo or was there any kind of parental involvement in this decision? And it was very baffling to me and my husband how they came to this. I mean, I think it ended up working out okay, where they're trying to please a lot of different parties, but it was kind of alarming.
Heather, thanks a lot for that call. And I'm guessing, Rebecca, Heather is not alone. Whatever people thought of a school district's ultimate decisions on COVID policies, a lot of people maybe caught off guard, not feeling like they were heard, not seeing transparency. How big an issue do you see this being?
I think this really also reflects that, you know, most of our locally elected school board members, this is often their first entree into local politics. Many of them have no desire to go on to higher offices. They're doing this out of a civic good and civic duty, a commitment to their community. And yet we've placed on them some very heavy decisions, things that we would have never expected years ago, you know, local school boards to have to be grappling with. And I think that's part of what's going on, is that these boards are really just overwhelmed and trying to figure out how to navigate this. And then sometimes that looks like waffling decisions or uncertainty, and all these different things come to the foreground. And so I think we need to remember that, you know, many times these are just our local neighbors that are really trying to do the best they can. And we really wish state government or federal government was providing them more guidelines rather than pushing it all down to them.
Thanks for that call, Heather. And yeah, that I got that sense a lot, Rebecca, not just with schools, that local things were looking for some kind of guidance from on high, state or federal government, not getting it. And with school boards, I know there's a lot of emphasis on local control and local decision making. Do school boards get stuck in difficult situations often because of that conflict, I guess, wanting that guidance, but having it left in their laps?
I think in a lot of places, you know, when there's agreement, it's great. Local citizens get to have a lot of influence. These are their friends and neighbors. They have lots of access to them. It's a lot harder to meet with your state representative than it is to bump into your school board representative at the local grocery store, or to be able to drive down their street and look for them and knock on their door. And so in some ways that provides a really wonderful democratic opportunity. But you know, it also means that they're now faced in this kind of environment with decisions that they were really never prepared to take on.
Talking to Rebecca Jacobson from Michigan State University, looking at the politics of education. Rebecca, with the issue of parental input, what is the most effective way for school boards to take that input and put it into practice, knowing that parent A might want something very different than parent B in the same district?
Yeah, and that's the real challenge, especially in districts where there's a large range of opinion, a lot of diversity, whether that's racial or class or just, you know, diversity of opinions. And so I think that's probably where we're seeing a lot of these heated debates are places where there isn't a prevailing opinion. So I do think it's really important that parents have access to these public meetings, that there's opportunities for public comment. But I also think that parents and public members have an opportunity or have a responsibility to engage in meaningful conversation, something that we've not had a lot of opportunity to do during COVID. But we need to get back to a place where we can respectfully disagree and remember that our schools are for everyone. It's not just about my child's education. It's really about what is for our community, and the roles that schools play for our entire society. And that might be different in the public good than it would be for what I would love for my exact child.
We've focused a lot, Rebecca, on school board politics. And we've had this Virginia governor's race. At least some of the exit polling suggests that education made a big difference, helping put the Republican candidate there over the top. What do you think of education as something that could sway elections and not just for, you know, those school boards?
Yeah, I teach politics of education. One of the things that I often say to my graduate students is I would really love for education to be less on the radar, because then you can actually take some time to figure things out and take some time to implement policies and have the opportunity to have a little bit of failure, but enough time to make it work before everybody's demanding new change. So I am concerned that, you know, on the one hand, it's great that we're focused on our schools. I think our schools are critical. We want to have everybody engaged and investing in them. But on the other hand, I worry that this is going to lead to more reform, a faster cycle of reform, such that we really just kind of end up not getting a whole lot of good done because we don't give anything a long enough chance to work itself out.
We just had really a handful of elections this year. What are you really watching for next in the politics of education?
I think school boards are going to continue to be a really important place, even if this particular issue around critical race theory or masks and different protocols related to COVID begin to fade away, because we've tried for a long time to change education from the federal level and push down. And what we've really realized is that if there's no local buy-in and local leaders aren't really engaged, we can't make a whole lot of difference. And so I think we need to figure out better ways to work with local leaders, but without co-opting them or just sort of using them in our national politics. I think there can be a lot of wisdom at the local level, and maybe going back to some of the slower, more pragmatic decision-making might actually do us some good.
We'll leave it there. Rebecca, thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's Rebecca Jacobson, professor in the College of Education at Michigan State University. She's also co-author of the book Outside Money in School Board Elections, The Nationalization of Education Politics. She joined us today to talk about a growing focus on education in elections up and down the ballot, including school board recall attempts here in Wisconsin, and the role the issue could play in the future. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show, mark Veterans Day in Wisconsin with the director of the state's Veterans Affairs Department and find out what the state is doing to observe the occasion. That's coming up tomorrow morning at 7:30 with Kate Archer Kent here on the Ideas Network. Do you ever get calls or emails or texts from work outside of business hours? Does it ever feel like it's too much? If so, here's a possible solution. Move to Portugal. As reported in USA Today, that country just passed a package of laws aimed at work-life balance. One of them makes it illegal for employers to contact their employees outside of business hours. Employers who violate the law could be subject to fines. Supporters of the law say it's needed because of the rising number of people working at home, and they're hoping to lure people to move to Portugal with policies friendly to remote workers. On the one hand, I get how that could sound attractive. On the other hand, if you're doing, say, a radio show, sometimes you really got to be in touch with each other outside of business hours. On the other hand, I hear they have some great scenery and good seafood in Portugal. And then there's that peri-peri chicken. Something to think about. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, there's a new moss in town, technically in a meadow in northeastern Wisconsin. We'll talk to a researcher who found the rare plant here in the state and find out why moss matters. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Brad Kohlberg with a story about an Army veteran who's turned to forestry and writing in Wisconsin's North Woods.
Brian Box served two tours in the United States Army in Afghanistan. Now he works in forestry in Wisconsin's North Woods. In 2019, Box wrote the essay, Ghosts of War in a Wisconsin Forest, for the New Republic, depicting his struggles with PTSD and the healing potential of the North Woods. I recently went to visit Box. We walked through the woods, recorded his essay, and talked about why he wrote it. A warning for listeners, the following contains descriptions of violence and self-harm.
Every day I start the ship by throwing on my marking gear. It's not as heavy as my kit in Afghanistan, just an easy 40-odd pounds with the paint. Instead of a blaze orange cruiser vest like the ones my coworkers use, I still take the old tactical vest I wore over my armor back then. See, when I first got in, I was with 1st Squadron, 4th Cavalry Regiment into eastern Afghanistan. And about a month before I was supposed to get out of the Army, they said, hey, needs of the Army, you gotta stay. And I did another 16 months in the Army, and that time I was the operations assistant, so I was running the Troop Operations Center. And yeah, I had the record in the squadron for the fastest medevac ever done, 11 minutes and 56 seconds from the time of the IED strike to the when the wheels went up and our guys were on their way to the medical center. So it's kind of crazy. You know, my first deployment, I was spending a lot of time shooting at people. And then my second deployment, my primary focus was getting all my guys home. I don't like taking life. I don't like suffering. You know, so that first deployment was kind of a wreck for me. And then the second one, I did my best to prevent that.
When he got home, Fox took a job in forestry in Wisconsin's Northwoods. And that's where the idea for the essay came to him.
I was working out on this timber sale that we're sitting in right now. And I was alone. I was working 60 hours a week alone, and I was having nonstop flashbacks. Thunderstorm passed through today, dropping walnut-sized hail and blowing trees down around me. I hid under a big sugar maple, and as trees dropped all around me, I realized that I couldn't remember precisely how many friends wound up in flag-draped coffins, but that more had died by suicide than from enemy action. I was thinking about it, and I was like, you know, maybe I should put this pen to paper, at least to try and excise whatever demon I was dealing with out there. When Dave and Adrian died instead of me, my commander and gunner killed by an IED, I blamed myself for years. I don't know, that was my albatross for a long time. Kind of drove me nuts there for a while. It took me a couple of years to recover after I got out of the Army, just from that high intensity, like constant paranoia, but.
Now, out in the forest, Box says he contends with post-traumatic stress on a regular basis.
Sometimes when I'm marking timber, I'll have a flashback and just stand there, staring off into space for God knows how long. I don't know if my coworkers have noticed. I tried to show people what it was like to just have that running in your head all the time. Like, that's what PTS feels like. You know, and that piece was a bit cathartic. I actually slept pretty darn well after that.
Box was also approved through the VA for an emotional support animal. His dog, Elias, is his constant companion.
Elias is like, he's been a lifesaver, and he keeps me focused on the present. Like when he's doing his 100-meter circle and he's happily doing his thing and rolling in wolf scat, much to my dismay, he helps me so much. Sometimes when I'm out marking alone, I'll catch something out of the corner of my eye, get the sneaking feeling I'm being watched. Often I'll find it's a deer, a bear, or if I'm really lucky, one of our wolves. But sometimes I don't find anything, just left with a feeling of a presence. I wonder whether it's my brain injury doing something sparky, but I'd like to imagine the entity as one of my dead friends come to walk with me under the emerald canopy.
Box has served his country in combat, but he still feels he owes a debt. And he says helping Wisconsin's North Woods to survive and thrive is how he can repay.
When I was a kid, we didn't have enough food to eat. And a USDA program to feed inner city kids when the summer break was happening, that was sometimes the only meal I got that day. And the veterans programs that my mom had access to, because she was a disabled vet in the Coast Guard. She got really badly injured on a rescue mission. Those programs that the American people offered to both me and my family kept me from starving. they economically empowered my mom to go and get a degree in electrical engineering, to be a successful postal worker and have a decent life. That's a debt that I'll never be able to repay, but I'm doing my best, you know, and if I can help the Northwoods sequester more carbon, I think that will be my contribution. I'll take that as an epitaph. I love this forest. Doing good forestry is like being the pen and writing a love letter to the forest. Fate, I have learned, is a haphazard forester, marking clumps for destruction, then cutting unevenly, leaving some stems behind, vulnerable to rot. But under the right conditions, the stumps can sprout anew. The hollowed out stems that remain can find new purpose.
Brian Box is a veteran of the United States Army and works in forestry in Wisconsin's North Woods. His essay, Ghosts of War in a Wisconsin Forest, was originally published in the New Republic. A full audio version can be heard on our website at wisconsinlife.org. If you or someone you know might need help, the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline is available 24/7 at 1-800-273-8255. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Brad Kohlberg.
Coming up, a moss enthusiast and UW-Green Bay professor tells us about the school's plant museum and a moss variety he and some volunteers came across that was previously uncatalogued here in the state. That's next here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, in this off-election year, anxiety over schools fired up voters around the country. How might those fears factor into who controls Congress this time next year? That's today at 6 on 1A+. Now, a quote to start things off. There will always be something new to discover. A minute moss never found before. A rabbit eating birdseed with the boars on a hungry November day. A bittern that stays only long enough to be remembered. Those words came from the late naturalist and author Anne Zwinger. And our next guest actually lived part of that, the moss part. Keir Wefferling is an assistant professor and curator of the Fewless Herbarium in UW-Green Bay's Coffrin Center of Biodiversity. He, along with volunteers, recently came across a moss that he'd never seen before and that's never been documented scientifically in Wisconsin before. Keir is with us now to talk more about the experience and the herbarium. Keir, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Set the scene for us first, Keir. Tell us about this field trip you and the volunteers were out on.
All right. So this was late September, and we had our rubber boots on and hand lenses and some collecting bags. And this was up in the Northeast Sands region of Wisconsin, up in Oconto County. And it is a state natural area. And we were just doing a preliminary survey of the bryophytes, the mosses and liverworts and hornworts that exist there, and set out through kind of a white cedar swamp. A very wet forest with a huckleberry understory and conifer overstory, and then lots of beautiful ferns and fern allies and hummocks of mosses, at least five different species of sphagnum moss in the understory. And we were doing what we call a meander survey, which it implies we don't know where we're going. And in this case, that was true. We were just sort of wandering toward the lake. And we expected to find a pretty rich bryophyte community, a rich moss community, just based on the geologic and glacial history of this part of Wisconsin. And there was a pretty rapid transition when we reached the edge of the lake. We stepped out onto this sort of quaking floating mat over a shallow lake, and encountered a very different moss community and a bunch of arecads, a bunch of blueberry relatives like cranberry and some leatherleaf and some Labrador tea and a few insectivorous or carnivorous plants. Now some rare orchids and sedges, and then we crossed this little inlet to the lake. It was a treacherous crossing. We only had, you know, our 12-inch rubber boots on and hoping not to go over the tops. And so I was out there with Joan Berkopek and Ron Eichhorn, and Joan and I have been collaborating on learning the mosses of the region just over the last few months to a year. And we were hunched over right by this inlet, and we were on opposite sides of a little clump of sedge, and both of us were exclaiming, look at this, check this out. And neither of us wanted to look at what the other was looking at, because what we were looking at was so cool. And I was starting to exclaim some you know, pretty colorful language, and because it was just such a strange looking little moss, but I didn't know what it was when I first saw it, nor did Joan. And turned out to be this little tufted fen moss, this beautiful little diminutive plant. And the tufted fen moss, as you correctly stated, it has not been found or documented in like a Western scientific framework before in Wisconsin, as far as I know, the people that were here before us and who are still here, Menominee and Ocheti Sakauin and Anishinaabeg, these First Nations people, they very likely had a relationship with the plant, knew about the plant. I've reached out, and I'm in communication with some colleagues in UW Green Bay's First Nations Studies program to learn more about these mosses and other plants and what they might tell us about the communities that we're in.
And Kira, stepping back a little bit, I think we might assume that scientists have already found all the stuff, all the species that are in a place, things like that. No, there's still some sense of, as you said, not really discovery exactly, because people probably knew about it hundreds of years ago, but a sense of finding something that at least our current scientific community didn't know was out there.
Yeah, it's super exciting. I think it definitely points to the fact that we don't know everything that's out there, and there's so much to learn. And I think getting people, you know, out to these special areas to look more closely at these communities is important. Building these collaborations and looking with in some cases new eyes.
As you mentioned, you have this effort to catalog moss. You are into moss lately. Give us a little quick moss 101. What is it? What does it do in an ecosystem?
Yeah, so mosses in the peatlands, these peat accumulating wetlands, where I've been really interested in spending more time in lately. So a peat accumulation occurs when production or fixation of carbon from the atmosphere outpaces decomposition, and that state of peat accumulation can occur in really acidic environments or really basic high alkaline high pH environments. This tufted fen moss was found in the latter, a boreal rich fen. So that's a mineral rich, nutrient rich, alkaline environment or plant community. Some of these acidic plant communities, like the bogs and the muskegs, the mosses are ecosystem engineers. They'll actually acidify their surroundings and sort of lay the stage for these other acid-loving vascular plants, the flowering and seed plants. So these mosses can be ecosystem engineers. They can be, in many cases, very sensitive to the abiotic conditions, the groundwater quality and quantity and temperature, water fluctuation regimes, and so forth. So they can tell us something. Well, they can tell us a lot simply by their presence about the conditions of a site. And I'm interested in sort of, you know, using these mosses in that framework as indicator species to tell us about these natural plant communities where we want to spend time and study and preserve and conserve, and they can really inform our understanding of the dynamics as our climate changes and as we impact our land more and more.
Talking to Kira Wefferling, assistant professor and curator of the Fewless Herbarium at UW-Green Bay's Cofran Center of Biodiversity, looking at the finding of a previously uncatalogued moss species here in Wisconsin. And something that struck me, Kira, in your description of where you found the moss. I will admit, I'm not a guy who's good at identifying plants. I walk through the woods and I can pick a tree, grass, flower, sure, that kind of thing, moss maybe.
Yeah.
But the incredible amount of diversity you just described in a very small area, for those who know what they're looking for. Can you talk about how much variety we can find in just maybe a few square yards in some places in the state?
I don't have a really tidy answer for that. I'm afraid. Yeah, a few square yards. We might see dozens of moss species, fewer vascular plant species. So it all depends on the community that you're looking for, right? There's also the liverworts, another bryophyte, another non-vascular land plant. These are plants that reproduce by spore and sometimes asexual propagules. They'll just sort of break apart, or they'll have specialized reproductive structures that are not necessarily due to sexual reproduction. And we're looking at the gametophyte stage in the mosses. They're haploid dominant, so they just have a single genome copy that governs, you know, how they interact with their environment. And the sporophyte, what I think we're used to interacting with, like when we look at a tree, that's the sporophyte generation, the diploid usually generation. In the case of the mosses and in the liverworts, the sporophyte's actually parasitic, essentially, on the gametophyte. It's growing out of and supported by the gametophyte. Hmm. It's got a wonderful little life cycle. Spore reproduction, and these spores, they can just disperse very long distances. So I've been asked in this case, the tufted fen moss, whether it might have just come here from somewhere else recently, and that's perfectly plausible. In this case, the tufted fen moss is actually single sex, so individuals will be either male or female. So that's a problem with dispersal. If you only get one sex, then you won't get reproductive. You won't get sexual reproduction after that initial colonization event.
Now, speaking of lots of plant diversity here, I don't want to run out of time without talking about the herbarium at UW-Green Bay. Can you talk about this, in effect, library of plants?
Yeah, great. The herbarium is basically a museum. It's a collection of dried pressed plant specimens. The Fewless Herbarium has about 45,000 dried vascular plant specimens, and I'm trying to add mosses to that. And there are like 13 other, as far as I can count, 13 other herbaria here in Wisconsin, about 3,000 in the world. And we're one of them, so we're, you know, storing these plants, and they're used for biodiversity studies. So they can inform phenology, geographic distribution, morphology, even in some cases, one can get molecular data from herbarium specimens, actually break off a piece of leaf and grind it up, get the DNA and sequence that DNA. I'm working on digitizing the collection, meaning taking high resolution photographs of every specimen I'm putting that on a public facing portal. So that, I think that's really exciting. A lot of herbaria are doing that these days, and really adds to the value.
And yeah, when can the public start getting a look at that digitized collection? So maybe people like me are better at spotting those plants out in the wild.
Sure. I don't know. Hopefully within a year or two. It's going to take quite a bit of time to get through our collection, and I'm still in the process of setting up that infrastructure. But I have really good support from the Cofran Center for Biodiversity and from the university as well. So hoping sooner than later, but we'll see.
In just our last few moments, do you have more moss expeditions in the works now?
Yeah, and that's one of the things that's, I guess, convenient or wonderful about mosses is that in many cases, they're evergreen, and you can visit them any time of the year as long as there's not snow on the ground. So I'm heading back out to some boreal rich fens actually next Thursday. So up in Door County, I'm looking for a few more mosses before the winter time.
Well, happy exploring, Keir. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob.
Keir Weffling is assistant professor and curator of the Fewless Herbarium at UW-Green Bay's Cofran Center of Biodiversity. Talked to him about a moss he recently identified that had not previously been documented in the state. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, it can be good to be connected to people, but maybe social media makes us too connected for our brains to handle. A guest makes the case for a slower social network. Plus, we'll check out an effort to provide more dental care to people in Wisconsin. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.